Okay, good morning, Hillel Fuld from Meadowlands, New Jersey. It is nice to see you again. You look a little tired. You are in Chicago, but I understand that you were not participating in the Democratic National Convention. We'll get to that in a couple of minutes. Just to give everybody some background, I started the podcast called Opening Up, SAR, kind of opening up about our philosophy and about educational issues and talking about them with a little bit of a broader audience. And like much of the world, stopped on October 7th. That was pretty much the last time, or a little bit before that, where I had my last episode. But one of my summer resolutions was to reopen that and to try to bring guests on again to talk about things that are important, to talk with people who matter and who are doing things that matter. And it is a very special zchut on many levels for me to be having this conversation with you. So thank you. Really appreciate it and hope you're doing well. I grew up actually in Hillel Fuld's home. Rabbi Yonah Fuld and Mary Fuld, in many ways, took me in. Thank God, I have wonderful parents. But Donnie Fuld, one of Hillel's older brothers, was a classmate of mine in the class of 1984 at SAR. Rabbi Fuld was the principal of SAR. He literally brought me to SAR, first in his car and then as the van driver for about 15 kids from Queens who weren't doing well in their traditional school environments. I'll speak for myself, I don't want to speak for you. So I really owe a tremendous amount, especially my connection to SAR, to the Fuld family. Hillel's brother Donnie, Hillel's older brother Moshe, all of the Fuld family lives in Israel. The next brother was Ari Fuld, a very wonderful person who was murdered a few days before Yom Kippur. Hillel, was it 6 years ago? Will it be 6 years?
Yes.
Yehi Zichro Baruch, Ari, and all of the Folds were tremendous lovers of Tzion, and he was killed as a lover of Tzion, as a defender of Tzion. And Hillel has another brother, Eitan, who's very involved in Medinat Israel, working within the Israeli government. So it's hard to find a family. It's certainly harder to find a family of Olim who are more involved in, committed to, and connected with Medinat Israel than the Fold family. My memories from being in SAR, Rabbi Fuld talking about 1967, talking about his parents' experience in the Shoah, and then talking about 67, talking about 73, talking about being here in New York, but really wanting to be there, and then eventually making Aliyah, as all of my predecessors, Rabbi Schwat, Zichrono Livracha, and Yibadlu L'Chaim, Rabbi Fuld, and Rabbi Cohn, who have all made their homes in Medinat Yisrael. And Rabbi and Mrs. Fuld are living in Yerushalayim. I saw them a few weeks ago. So really a very special family to me personally and a very special family to SAR. Now, Hillel, did you graduate SAR?
Yes.
You did. I was trying to figure out the years and it didn't make sense to me. First, I thought that you left in the middle, but you did graduate SAR. So, okay, you graduated SAR and then went, and did you go to high school here?
Yeah, 9th grade MTA, 10th grade Chorev. Quite a transition.
MTA and Chorev. You made Aliyah with your family after 9th grade and you've been living there ever since.
That is correct. Beginning, as you can imagine, 10th grade moving to Israel was not an easy transition for me. And so in my mind, get through high school and get into the military, and then I'm out of here. Actually, it's a story that I don't think I've ever told, which is that out of Herschel Schechter, Shlita came to KBY when I was there. So I finished high school, finished army, and I was learning in yeshiva, and son was, and I was talking to him. I'm like, I'm getting out of here. I'm like, I got to get him. And he was like, what are you even saying? Of course you're staying here. I don't know exactly why he had such a strong impact on me, but he's definitely one of the people that kind of encouraged me to stay. And obviously now, 30 years later, it was the best thing that ever happened to me, and we're living a dream.
Amazing. So you did graduate SAR. Tell me about your memories, or hopefully the good ones.
Yeah, other than the fact that our teachers used to smoke in the classroom. But no, SAR were the best years of my life. On the one hand, you're the principal's son, so you're never going to reach the cool kid level. But it was amazing. The teachers were amazing. The friendships were amazing, many of which I still have till today. And honestly, it's my claim to fame, right? Anybody who's ever studied at SAR will react the same way. Are you Rabbi Fuld's son, right? And my parents and my dad, they're both pretty epic people. Yeah, SAR was and continues to be an unbelievable educational institution, but far beyond.
I think growing up in your home, you obviously lived the values of SAR 24 hours a day. And like I said, your father, for me personally, and for so many of us, our connection and our association with Israel first came really through, in many ways, through SAR and through your father. Are there any particular memories that you have specifically related to Medinat Israel in terms of your experiences at SAR that come to mind?
Yeah, obviously, Yom HaAtzmaut, the whole discussion in the Jewish world. Bracha, Hallel, blah, blah, blah. I think that my father not only taught me, and I guess all of the students, the importance of Yom HaAtzmaut and the importance of saying thank you, but as like most things, he was fiery, passionate about it.
Very much.
So I think that the Zionism, specifically Yom HaAtzmaut, but obviously the entire Zionist philosophy, I think, was drilled into my DNA from a very young age, and both as the principal son, but also as a student at FAR. I just think Zionism was a very fundamental kind of pillar of the education we received at SAR.
Right, and like I said, for so many of us, and right, memories of Yom HaAtzmaut, gathering challah on the steps, which is a minhag that has been going on for many years. Obviously, Ivrit, your father actually, through Bar Ilan, through the Lichtenstein Center at Bar Ilan, wrote a curriculum that we now use in school, in SAR, and is used in many schools to teach the history, right? It's not just about the passion, and you have to know what you're passionate about. So it was very important to him that we learn about, and that kids learn about Israel, and that's something that is now happening through the curriculum that since he's been to Israel, he was involved in writing many booklets that we use in all the grades to teach kids about Medinat Yisrael, to teach them about Tzionut. But I have to tell you that it's hard to replace that passion and that, what you described as that fire instinct that he had. I think that made such an impression on me and to so many of us who are now parents or teachers or otherwise around at SAR. It's something that you know about very much.
I always tell my dad this, but he hasn't spoken about publicly, I don't think I have, but every time I meet R. Michael Eisenberg, wherever I meet him, he tells me the same story every single time. I'm telling you, it's the funniest thing. He told me that he was talking to my dad about Israel at some point, and my father said, Michael, you can own part of the rock. Go buy property. You can own part of the rock.
And he does.
And Michael said he was a really strong force in him eventually making Aliyah. And obviously, anybody who knows Michael, he hasn't just made Aliyah. The guy supported the Israeli economy and given more people jobs than most people that I know. Again, that one sentence and that one kind of push that my father gave him and many thousands of others really impacted his life and, in his case, helped him make a decision. Maybe one of the biggest decisions ever made in life.
Amazing story. Michael was my chavrusa and Rabbi Rosenzweig here in YU, and Michael's a special guy, and I know that how much he has done and does for the state of Israel. So great to hear. So let's shift gears a little bit. You're living in Israel. You went to Chorev. You're growing up. I know we're both still growing up, but you're older. And I remember your mother telling me you're writing like technical writing for kind of Converse or something like that. Is that accurate? Tell me about that.
So I went to Bar Ilan University. I studied political science, not because I ever thought of going into politics, just because, I don't know, it seemed like an interesting degree, and I guess it was relatively easy. My grades were fine from Corey, but as you can imagine, making Aliyah middle of high school, I wasn't the top of my class, so I can't say I had that many choices as far as what I was doing, whether it was law or something else. I did a degree in political science, really enjoyed it, but then I was like, okay, now what? What do you do with a degree in political science if you're not going into politics? And at the time, it was basically like a default. If you're American, you live in Israel, you go do technical writing. Someone said to me, go be a technical writer. I didn't know what that was. And I started studying technical writing, and I was writing user guides for a company called Converse, which is the company that basically invented voicemail. So at the time, they were wow. Now, as you can imagine, they longer exist. But that's how I started my career. My answer is super cliche, and I sound maybe like Tony Robbins, but honestly, all that I had when I started, and I'll tell you exactly how it happened, but all that I had in the beginning and early days of my career, the only thing that I had was passion. Again, I know it sounds cliche, but the reality is that I find myself at my job bored, and I said to myself, this is clearly not what I should be doing with my life. And I said, I love tech, I love writing. I'm gonna start writing on the internet. And I bought a domain, I bought a website, started writing. There was no business model because blogging wasn't a thing back then. Surely it was not social media or the iPhone or any of this stuff. And I get to work, make a cup of coffee and write a quote unquote blog post. And everyone's like, what is this thing you're writing? I don't make money from this. And I was like, this isn't a money making thing. This is my passion. I love tech. I love writing. So I would write these posts. And basically within a couple of months, entrepreneurs discovered my writing. I don't know how, I don't know where, but they'd reach out. They'd say, my name is so-and-so. I read your article about whatever. I'd love to meet you. And I would meet these entrepreneurs. Again, there was no business involved. But what I learned is that what we say in Hebrew or in Israel, being a friar, right, being a sucker, helping someone for free while it's looked down upon in Israeli society is actually the best business model in the world. Because instead of selling yourself and saying, I could do A, B, C, D, E, F, G, now pay me, you just show what you can do. And that company says, holy cow, this guy like is seriously valuable to us. He's indispensable to us. And at that point, they come to me and they say, listen, we know what you did for us. They're aware of your abilities because you demonstrated them. You didn't promise anything. You just delivered. And then they come to me and then I have the leverage and they need me. And so it's a whole business model backwards. And that's what I did over the last 15 years. And I built a multi-million-dollar consulting business. Really, like I always say, if I'm like a kid in a candy store, just meeting the most remarkable people every day. And it was a dream come true from a professional perspective.
So before blogs were much of a thing, and then it got out there, and then obviously it morphed from there into the things that you're doing. So you say you're a consultant. Is that what you have? Are you a consultant to multiple companies, or are you mostly putting things out there and then taking different projects?
Stuff that I put out there, let's call it, that's what built the brand. But my bread and butter consultant, call it advisor, whatever you want to call it, but companies that need strategic help when it comes to growth. And it's strategic. I'm not running their Twitter account, but I am building a strategy whether they should be on Twitter in the first place. And so I worked with Kai. My portfolio, again, pre-war was very diverse, from two guys in a garage building a biotech company to Google and Silicon Valley and Oracle and Microsoft, everyone in like a different bandwidth and capacity. It was a pretty great business. It's basically a professional dream because I just got to meet the most amazing people and love every second of it and get paid.
You're obviously, we talked about your father's passion. Your passion certainly comes out of everything that you do and just about everything that you say. And I'm sure that is, clearly that is attractive to people who want to work with you or want to learn from you. Is it all Israel-based?
First of all, how do you define Israeli company? Is it Israeli founder? I do have companies in Silicon Valley that I worked with. I mentioned Google, but even startups. But Google, when I worked with Google, it was Google Silicon Valley Mountain View, not Israel. But the vast majority were Israeli companies, which means that they were founded in Israel. It does not mean they didn't have American offices. Almost all of them did. It was a company founded by Israelis and has Israeli headquarters.
Okay, so definitely the most part of Israeli founded, and definitely, obviously, the connections, they run through Israel for the most part in one way or another. And obviously, you were very successful with that. I dabble in social media. For some reason, I can never turn your notifications off, so I get them all the time. I know that you don't sleep. I watched you drink Red Bull in my home, so I know that's one of your secrets that I'm now publicizing to the world. But definitely, I remember before October 7th, you had stuff to say about Israel when you wanted to, whether it was about Israel or about anti-Semitism. But it felt like pretty much you were a tech writer. That's the way you described yourself, and that's the things that you did. And when you came in even a bunch of years ago, you spoke to some of our kids, and you spoke elsewhere in New York. A lot of it, or most of it, was about technology, Startup Nation, etc. Then, and you've described this yourself, something changes after October 7th. So first of all, tell me about your experience on October 7th.
Okay, so we're about to get a little dark here, Robert Krauss. People talk a lot about the word trauma, right? Traumatized, right? Being said traumatized. Trauma is a very real thing, as most people know. It's a real thing with real symptoms, one of which is selective memory, selective amnesia, whatever you want to call it. And honestly, the day Ari was murdered, and I remember that day like it was yesterday. I remember what socks I was wearing. I can't remember a thing afterwards, like complete blackout. I don't remember literally for months. I don't remember. You could tell me I went to the Bahamas and I believe you, like zero recollection. That, and I'll tell you why I'm mentioning that in a second, but that's a very clear symptom, right? And October 7th, we were in shul.
Sorry, just to make sure that people know, 6 years ago, Ari was stabbed. He was stabbed. I remember that day in a different way, too. I was in Israel the next day to be with your family, and one of the first things that we learned about and we talked about was the fact that he, if I understand correctly, shot the terrorist before he was able to kill other people. Is that accurate?
Yeah, but it was actually only the fact that he shot him. He got stabbed in the main artery, and despite the fact that he was basically medically dead, he meant to chase the terrorist hundreds of feet, jump over a wall, and shoot the terrorist, which, as you knew Ari, typical, that's how he lived, that's how he died, right? He's not meant to.
Right.
You're gonna bring me down, you're going down with me.
Right.
Yeah, so that day, obviously, still feels like yesterday. Number one, it also feels like a lifetime ago. But anyway, so that I kind of blacked out or locked that out afterwards. Same happened on October 7th. I remember being in shul. I remember the way the shul with my twins were hearing rockets above, which, as ludicrous as this is to say, which was a relatively normal thing, so we weren't too worried. And we get to shul, and I don't know if it was in Laney or Akafos, whatever, siren number one. We run to the mamad, we run to the bomb shelter where, you know, hundreds of people, a bomb shelter that's equipped for 20 people. The women went inside, the men found cover somewhere else, and we went back to davening, and then back in the van. It was weird. We were like, what is going on? Nobody had their phones on them, so we didn't really know anything. But when people started to get called up to the army, we were like, okay, something's going on. And then the rumors started in shul, oh, there's thousands of terrorists who came to Israel. And I was the first to say to everyone, would you stop spreading hysteria? Thousands of terrorists are not coming to Israel. Why are you spreading this rumor? Stop it. I remember that. I remember a few days later doing what I'm doing now. I do not remember finding out. I do not remember the second I turned on my phone and found out. I completely blocked that or blackout on that. Zero recollection, which is a crazy thing. You might play tricks on you, but that's the reality. I don't remember it at all.
Yeah. So traumatic day for the world, for the United Israel, and for you. And again, obviously connections to past traumas, which neither of us are psychologists, but we can certainly connect those dots. Okay, but then it is a few days later, and you're in Israel, and in theory you can wake up in the morning and try to get back to to what we call your day job, even though your day job is obviously always involves talking to people. But it seems like your focus has really never gotten back since then. So could you tell us about that?
Sure. So in a way, Ari and I, we operated in kind of parallel spheres. We both were promoting Israel, right? He was promoting Israel through Israel advocacy. I was promoting Israel through tech. But the underlying mission that I had was always to promote Israel. It's just that I did it in a way that there's more consensus, right? Who doesn't love tech? And I would say that October 7th just peeled that layer off, and I just got rid of the let's promote Israel through tech, let's just defend Israel. I would say I had about 100% clarity that day that everything I had done till now, I did for this. And this was the time to leverage my platform and my followers, et cetera, to fight lies about Israel. And so I shut down my business October 8th and completely repurposed everything, all my platforms, my writing, the whole thing, to basically carry out a two-pronged mission. One is to be a source of real-time, accurate information. Real-time and accurate are generally mutually exclusive because it's real-time, you can't verify. I mean, if it's accurate, you verify, it's not real-time. But because I'm able to get feeds from different formal sources, like the Knesset, the Eitan, maybe, and the Dover Tzal, the IDF spokesperson in different offices, I'm able to cross-reference before I post anything to make sure that I'm being accurate. And for the most part, with very few exceptions, I was successful so far at that mission to, even though I'm getting a lot of obviously fake news, and I'm very careful to verify it. And that's the first part. The second part of the mission is inward, is for our team, and that is to give people a reason to wake up in the morning. I give people something to smile about, any good news in the war, or any inspirational video, any father coming home to his daughters or sons, and all that stuff. And just to be a kind of a source of some positivity and hope, because we're all in deep devastation, obviously. So that's what I've been doing since October 7th. And it's been successful is obviously not the right word. I'd love nothing more than not have to do this stuff. But I have this platform that I think puts me in a very, very unique position, which is that I have the ear of the tech world, right? As the tech world, generally speaking, the tech world is predominantly liberal, aka anti-Israel, or close to anti-Israel. And so because they know me and trust me as a tech guy, when I share stuff about Israel, they don't just dismiss me. They always another Hasbara guy. Tillel, our colleague, we know him and we trust him. So I have the ear of the tech world across my platform. So it's Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, YouTube, TikTok. I'm approaching the 2 billion impressions since the beginning of the war, which also is a nice metric for me, but the real metric and the one that I'm most proud of are the thousands of messages that I've gotten from people since the beginning of the war saying to me, I simply did not know that's what Zion is, or I was completely misled about Israel. And many people have said to me, I actually either changed their mind or at least opened their eyes to another perspective. And that to me is really what I'm most proud of. And I'd say the second thing I'm most proud of is the fact that I have lost my cool one time on social media, which with all the hate that I'm getting is actually something that I'd like to toot my own horn.
Well, take it. I hope you don't lose your cool when you get off of social media. You said, talking about the tech world, like, who is your audience? Kids in America, adults in America, Israelis, English speakers, non-Jewish people, who is it?
Who I see, there's really three groups on the internet. There's our group, quote unquote, pro-Israel people who get it. We don't need convincing, but we absolutely do need reinforcement, strengthening, and knowledge. Then there's the third group, the opposite, which are the people that I call the Heil Hitler folks who, I don't know, I wrote them off. I'm not getting through those people. They just are blind and deaf. They don't want to know anything. They don't want to hear anything. So I've written those people off. And once in a while, I'll get to one of them, and that's just a big win for me, but I'm not targeting those people at all. The middle group, which based on my anecdotal evidence, are the vast majority of people, which is people not necessarily that are pro-Israel, but they have integrity and they're willing to listen, they're willing to hear you. And that's many hundreds of people in the tech world. So those are my target people, that's my target audience. And again, there have been so many people who have reached out and said to me, I didn't know any of that. And so it's very satisfying, very gratifying for me and for, I would say, the state of Israel. I don't know if this is true or if this is accurate, but someone said to me that I have the farthest reach in the state of Israel as an individual without an organization behind him, right? There's no money behind me. Again, it made me feel good, but at the end of the day, if I'm being fully transparent, it's like I said, great for my neshama, great for the state of Israel, not so great for my bank account.
Okay, I know that you're a big believer in doing things that matter, and then the rest flows from there, and hopefully that will be the case, and that should be the case for you in terms of this as well. So you spoke about the people that, let's call them the message of appreciation. We all know that words of encouragement go a long way. I know that you sometimes, and you referenced it here, you get some pretty ugly responses as well. Does that hurt?
So many years ago, I went to visit a friend of mine in L.A. He's a big social media guy, I shall remain unnamed, but somebody very big, very big. And I asked him that question. I was like, how do you handle all the hate? Every post that you post, you get thousands of hate messages. He said to me, I don't read that stuff. What do you mean you don't read that stuff? He says, I tweet and I mute. I don't read the replies. And I remember thinking to myself, this was years ago, I remember thinking to myself, it defeats the purpose. Isn't it called social media? We're supposed to interact with people, right? What's the point? You might as well just write a blog. What do you mean? And I, at the time, I remember thinking, that's crazy. But that's what I've done during the war, because it's become completely and utterly unmanageable, unbearable. The people writing are truly demented. Once in a blue moon, I'll go back in to kind of see what people wrote, and then I remember why I started muting them.
Okay, that sounds like an approach, and obviously there are many responses. But wherever we are, anybody doing anything public or semi-public or even within small groups, you obviously have to know how to respond to the way people respond to you. You also have to get your beliefs and your core values from yourself, and it's not going to come from anybody else. And in your case, that's clear. I also know, because I do read a lot of the things that you write, that you, if you make a mistake, you admit it. I'm sure people appreciate that, and that adds to your integrity.
Yeah, on the one hand, like I said before, I'm super, super careful about what I share, but there have been instances where I was given information from a formal source. For example, just to give one example, when there was Muhammad Def, that I was told that we got him weeks before Israel actually announced that we got him. Again, I was given that information by many formal sources, so I posted it, and it wasn't yet confirmed. Obviously, at the end of the day, it was right, but it wasn't yet confirmed. But a few instances that I did share something that wasn't 100% accurate, I did apologize. But there's also, you have to remember, there's many instances where it's half accurate, right? Give an example, which obviously the issue itself doesn't matter, but the J Post reported that America gave Iran the names of the Mossad agents that killed Hania, which was like, what? The story didn't even make any sense to me. Like, why would Israel give that? The whole thing didn't make any sense. But it was reported by the J Post, quoted by JNS, it was all over the place. I posted it. And then J Post ended up deleting their article, which I don't even know what that's about. It's highly unprofessional to do such a thing. They should have added maybe a disclaimer. But the comments in that post are like, why are you spreading fake news and whatever? And there have been instances where it's great. And when things like that happen, the comments are just, you're such a propagandist. What are you doing? You gotta strike that balance. It's not easy.
Some people might disagree with that. When people say they don't talk about politics, like everyone talks about politics, everyone cares about politics because politics matters. So maybe I'm misquoting you. But I'd love to hear how you would respond to that.
Today, especially in Israel, you can't really separate politics and real life. Politics is real life. I definitely don't shy away from it like maybe I used to, because of the tech world. I don't know if I want to get on people's bad sides. Obviously, since the war, I'm a lot more, let's quote unquote, political or talking about political issues. But again, I'm not unable to make that kind of separation. So for me, when I'm talking about politics, I'm talking about life.
Okay, that's fair. Something that goes both ways. You're obviously, your English is excellent, but you are an Israeli citizen. You can vote in Israeli elections. You're an American citizen, correct? You're still an American citizen. The question doesn't apply to you in the same way, but one of the things that sometimes people say to me, if I express an opinion about Israel, is I have no right to have an opinion because I don't live there. I usually feel like I don't have the right to vote because I don't live there and I'm not a citizen, but I do think that I have the right to have an opinion. And you have the right to ignore my opinion or for my opinion to be wrong, which plenty of people do. I would ask it for you both ways in terms of the whole world has opinions about Israel. And do we have that right to an opinion? And what are the limits of those rights? And I guess back at you, you've commented on things going on in the world or particularly in America right now. And what are the limits of that? Now, again, you're an American citizen. You could say that might make it different. But I'm just curious about the way you think about that.
First of all, the whole double loyalty thing or one issue vote. Maybe I'm missing something here. Doesn't everyone vote on the issues that are important to them?
Yes.
For me, Israel is important, and that's American is politics and Israeli politics are intertwined. So that's number one. Number two, like you said, I'm an American citizen. Number three, I pay American taxes. But on a more fundamental level, the question, which as you can imagine, appears in my social media all the time, who are you? Why are you talking about American politics? The question to me is not aimed at you, but it's a condescending question. You're telling me what I'm allowed to talk about? Mm. I care about this stuff. I care about America. I'm an American. America's been amazing to my family. Why am I entitled any less than someone else to have an opinion? Because I don't live there? If I lived there, what would be the difference? It would be the same issues that are important to me. So I don't think anybody's going to tell anyone what they're allowed to talk about. Obviously, the Jews around the world are affected by the war, so everyone's entitled to their opinion. And I think that the question should be, do you feel as a person that, A, you care deeply about the issues at hand, and does it affect your life? And both the answers to that question are yes, and so that's why I feel the liberty of talking about American politics, but there should be no doubt, every time I do, I get absolutely hammered by people saying, you live in Israel, what do you even... But I don't buy into that narrative. It's on the long list of things that people say to me on social media that are pet peeves.
Okay, that's fair. And I guess, so then, you know, it sounds like you agree with me the other way as well, right? In other words, people here have the right to have an opinion about Israel, and they have the right for their opinion to be totally wrong, and you have the right to argue with them, and that's what we do in conversations and online.
100%. I would say with one asterisk, and this is, again, obviously just my opinion, but I have a real problem on both ends of the spectrum. Doesn't matter where you live, whatever. I have a big problem with the need of Jews throughout history, not just now, to air our dirty laundry. In other words, just to give a very extreme example, there was that very, I don't even know what, that scary, I would say, story of there being Israeli soldiers who were looking after the terrorists and did obviously certain acts that was obviously very public, very widely publicized because it vilified Israel. And it was an Israeli journalist who shared that story, and everyone, of course, bought it because that's what the world does when it's bad about Israel. It turns out that this dude, like, doctored the video and just is a full-blown, I don't want to give it names, but this guy felt the need to air our dirty laundry. In this case, it wasn't even real, to the whole world. And that's something that we do. And every time I get the most hate on social media, somehow the person's name is always involved, David, or whatever. It's unbelievable. And so it's one thing, I would say, to express your opinion, whether I'm in Israel expressing about American politics or you're an American expressing about Israeli politics. But I do think we have to be a little bit responsible and loyal to our people. And remember that the world doesn't need another reason to vilify Israel and more propaganda. So right. If someone has a really horrible opinion about whatever topic, the prime minister, whatever it is, by all means, criticize.
There could be no disagreement about whatever you put out there, especially if you have the power of thousands or hundreds of thousands of followers. You better have information that's correct. I would imagine that people would argue that if the information is correct, that sometimes the only way to make movement is to talk about it. I remember that not so long ago, or maybe multiple times, and it was covered in the press, I think, here, that you told American Jews that the writing's on the wall and we shouldn't be living here. Is that something that, first of all, did I quote you accurately, basically? And do you stand by it? And how do people respond to it? Yeah.
Obviously, I get a ton of heat whenever I write about that stuff. When I say American Jews, we write it on the wall, and they're like, oh, it's not so easy to just pick up, and Israel's so hard to live in, and the October 7th, and there are all the answers in the world. And before I even express my opinion on the issue, disclaimer, this all comes from a place of love. I'm not judging anyone. I came to Israel when I was 15. I didn't make any decisions or sacrifices. My parents brought me here, so I'm a big talker. That being said, as uncomfortable as it is, or it's inconvenient to hear the words, get the hell out, the only thing I keep telling myself when I get all that hate back from American Jews saying basically get off our backs, the only thing I keep telling myself is if someone had just told Esther Varga, my grandmother in Europe in 1930, whatever, read the writing on the wall, get the hell out, obviously things would have turned out very differently. Thank God she survived, but I'm saying it's not fun to hear. But on the other hand, my question to my American friends, and again, they don't like hearing it, but the question is, if I put a gun to your head and I said, you have an hour to be on an LL plane or I'm pulling this trigger, presumably most people would be on a plane because they have a gun to their head, which just means logically that people who don't get on a plane do not believe that what's going on today in America or around the world constitutes a gun. And so my question to my friends is, what does? Because the way I see it, there are anti-Semites in Congress, there are shuls being vandalized, there are windows being smashed, there are Jews being beaten in the streets, there's court cases to convince a college to let Jews walk freely on campus. Like, how have we gotten here? And so to me, looking from the side, that's, again, disclaimer, disclosure, I'm looking from the side. It seems to me there's never been more writing on the wall, and nothing hasn't happened. And so that's my question. What does constitute a gun for you to say, I am out of here, that's it, we're done?
So I'm a little older than you, but neither of us were around in 1936, 37, 38. Do you think that America today is comparable to 36, 37, 38, Europe?
I guess I'll be a good Jew and answer your question with a question.
Perfect.
Was 1936 Germany the same as Spain? Was Spain the same as whatever ancient Egypt or Rome or Greece or any of these places that exiled and persecuted us? It was different in every generation. So it puts on a different mask. And so I'm not saying that America 2024 is a copy paste of Europe 1936. Of course not. But if you look, you know, take a step up and look at the reality, Jews being beaten, you see the rhetoric, you see the politicians, you see the mass marches and protests. Again, so the anti-Semitism is not hiding anymore. And so it's not comparable in the fact that it's copy-paste. And it's not comparable in the fact that there's going to be concentration camps in America. That's not what I'm saying. But it is comparable to the fact that if you look at society from the normal guy on the street to the politicians, anti-Semitism become pretty mainstream in American society today.
Okay. You're, as we all know and can tell, you're a passionate person. I think you're a very positive person, even though some of your perspectives now are a little bit dark, as you said, but I think that you're a very positive person. So I would imagine that you're bullish on, I don't know, the next 12 months, the next couple of years. in Medinat Israel. Can you give us some perspective on that?
Yeah. So one of the questions that I get when I speak to American Jews, which is all the time, is what, you're safer over there? You had October 7th. What do you mean? There are bombs falling on your head there. What are you even talking about, right? Which is a fair question. Like, why am I pushing Israel and saying America's not safe when Israel's not safe? Fair question. But basically my answer to that is that there's a fundamental difference, in my opinion, between a failed mission and no mission at all, right? October 7th, the IDF failed miserably, colossal failure. And that doesn't mean there's no mission. The IDF exists to protect me. Whereas outside of Israel, there's no mission. Nobody's looking after the Jews. Nobody cares about the Jews. You see these occurrences. Where's the police? Nobody cares. Yes, it's a super dark time, a rough time in Israel's history. But at the end of the day, I hit like a brick wall. And so I take a step back and I say, Hashem, you got a good sense of humor. I don't know what you're doing, but clearly he's running the show. And I think at the end of the day, I think that we're going to not only win this war, but we have to take a step back and look at history. And I always talk about this, but it's so worth repeating. And that is that we celebrate every one of our holidays. I don't know how many of your listeners or viewers think about this. And I got to be honest, I didn't think about this my entire life. But what is Purim? We celebrate Purim. Everyone loves Purim. What happened on Purim? Purim, the leader of the free world, right? Ahasuerus wasn't a king. He was the king. 127 countries agreed to annihilate us. We were done. That was it. That was the literal genocide of the Jewish people. We were done. And if you lived in the time of Purim and I told you that one day we would celebrate, you would have thought I was the biggest schmo in the world. And here we are celebrating. And so that is true about Purim, and it's true about Hanukkah. We were not winning that war. There was no way we were winning that war. And Pesach, 210 years of backbreaking slavery, and here we are celebrating. So I'm not only optimistic, I'm hopeful, and I know that not only are we going to win this war, we're going to come out stronger, and that we are, as I have said a zillion times in this war, because to me, this sums the whole thing up. We will dance again.
We will dance again. I appreciate the message. I will say, I think I must say, as someone who is living here, I've been to Israel 6 times since October 7th, and I have family there. I don't think that we have no mission here. I think there's a Jewish community that does have a strong mission here and believe deeply in Jewish values, and included in those Jewish values are a connection to Israel. And I also think that it's not accurate that nobody cares about us. I think that we have wonderful relationships within our community. The police department cares about us, and a lot of the politicians we have wonderful relationships with, and they care about us, and they show up, and those are things that we're happy happy with, and I think that's important to mention. It's obviously not everybody; it's not without its problems, and we could talk about those for a long time. At the same time, and part of the mission of this school is that optimism that you share about the state of Israel, about Medinat Israel, and about really the center of the Jewish people, and nobody can disagree at all with that. Going back to where we started, somebody who's family and whose lifeblood was SAR and everything that SAR stood for, and certainly you, the impact that you've had and that you're having through the work that you do and through the passion that you have, is something that many of us appreciate and benefit from. You wanted to have the last word, which I'll allow.
The last word, I just want to be very clear. I don't want anybody to misunderstand me. Of course, the Jewish people in America have a mission. That's not what I was referring to. Of course, people care about the Jewish people. What I'm saying is that there is no IDF there.
Right.
And, you know, when you see a 400x% increase in anti-Semitic events in Toronto, I think, or in Canada, like 70% of the hate crimes are targeting Jews, you ask yourself, why is no one looking after us? And Jews and shuls are being vandalized, and everything that's happening, yeah, okay, there are security guards and whatever, but at the end of the day, is someone preventing this insane increase of anti-Semitism? That's what I meant when I said there's no IDF there whose mission is to protect the Jewish people. That's all I meant. Not that the Jewish people there don't have a mission. Of course they do.
Okay, I appreciate it and understood. And I hope that you enjoy the rest of your time here. And I know that we'll know exactly when you land, because you'll tell us. Thank you again for taking the time to be with us and with our listeners. And regards to Racheli.
Done. Thanks for having me.